this thing. We are, I think, looking back, as any individual does in crisis, back to their origin story to say, where do we come from? And I think it's important that Americans have always made King George the enemy and the bad guy and an idiot and a madman, and he's not. He is an incredible, as the British Library shows, that his book collection is this literally the center of that magnificent building.
Bigger than Donald Trump's.
Ken,
I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to have to leave it there. But I'd like to congratulate you on this documentary series. It's simply wonderful in its scope and its depth and its seriousness of purpose. And people can see it in the United Kingdom. It'll premiere in June on BBC iPlayer. Ken Burns, America's, maybe the world's, premier documentary maker. That's it for me today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. But coming now, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Andrew, thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You are listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
And in the next couple of hours, a US submarine has sunk an Iranian naval ship near Sri Lanka. We'll have the latest on the conflict in the Middle East, and we'll talk about what's left of the special relationship with the former British ambassador to the US, Lord Darroch. The PM has defended his position on the war at PMQs. We'll talk through what we learned with a former Downing Street advisor. We'll also discuss the next country on Donald Trump's list. Plus, Vassos Alexander is here to talk about everybody's favourite sports topic, VAR, and what to do about it. And after 3:30, our big guest today is the Labour MP Naz Shah, who has told us all about her remarkable life story in a new memoir called Honoured.
And all of that happens after the very latest news from Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer's reiterated his initial position on the use of UK air bases in the war against Iran. He's told the Commons he wasn't prepared to join the conflict on Saturday unless he was satisfied there was a lawful basis and a viable thought-through plan. On Sunday, he said UK bases could be used for defensive operations. Donald Trump has said Starmer is no Churchill, but the PM rejects that characterisation.
American planes are operating out of British bases. That is the special relationship in action. British jets are shooting down drones and missiles to protect American lives in the Middle East on our joint bases. That is the special relationship in action. Sharing intelligence every day to keep our people safe. That is the special relationship in action. Hanging on to President Trump's latest words is not the special relationship.
The US Defense Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship which, quote, thought it was safe in international waters. Pete Hegseth says the ship was sunk by a torpedo. He says it's the first sinking of an enemy ship by a torpedo since World War II. He says the Iranian regime will be destroyed.
We are only 4 days into this, and the results have been incredible. Historic, really. Only the United States of America could lead this. Only us. But when you add the Israeli Defense Forces, a devastatingly capable force, the combination is sheer destruction for our radical Islamist Iranian adversaries. They are toast, and they know it.
Here, three men have been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. The Met Police says the suspects, 39, 43 and 68, were arrested by counter-terror officers in London and Wales after being accused of assisting a foreign intelligence service. All three remain in custody. The Guardian says one of them is the partner of a sitting Labour MP and another is the partner of a former Labour MP. Security Minister Dan Jarvis has been updating MPs.
We remain deeply concerned by an increasing pattern of covert activity from Chinese state-linked actors targeting UK democracy. This involves attempts to obtain information on UK policymaking and interfere with our sovereign affairs.
The government has launched a review to tackle anti-Semitism in schools and colleges. Anti-Semitic incidents related to education are double pre-2023 levels. Police have raided the Police Federation's national headquarters in Leatherhead in Surrey. City of London police made three arrests on suspicion of fraud by abuse of position. And Luke Donald will captain Europe's Ryder Cup team for a third time at Adair Manor in Limerick in 2027. He's aiming to make history by winning three tournaments in a row. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Yes, that is who we are. This one's Fee, the other one's Jane. We're with you every weekday afternoon, barring Fridays, from 2 till 4, and it is incredibly busy every day. We've made it to the middle of the week, though, everybody. Well done on that. Give yourself a round of applause. We've got an awful lot to pack into the next couple of hours. Stay with us on our journey to the outer limits of global patience. Is it really a special relationship? That's the first question we're going to start with. Aren't we all just dancing around the fact that we're actually in a rather abusive relationship with America? The name-calling, the love me one moment, hate you the next. What are we meant to do? Questions that we will consider with Kim Darroch, Lord Darroch, former ambassador to the US, after 3 o'clock. We're going to start, though, in this hour of the programme by looking back at a really imperative PMQs, and we'll do that with James Nation, deputy head of Rishi Sunak's Downing Street policy unit. Has Trump set his sights on Cuba next? We'll also be discussing that in the next half an hour of the programme. Don't worry, though, light relief comes in the form of considering whether a Channel 4 show hosted by Jonathan Ross, where couples are handcuffed together in the hope that good TV will emerge from the fact that they don't get on but have to, is that the thing that our country really needs? Scott Bryan will be here to posit that question to you all. We're 0333 003 2353. Do join in with anything that we are discussing. And after 3:30 this afternoon, a really extraordinary life story.
It certainly is. It's Naz Shah MP. She's the Labour MP for Bradford West. And she has been through a tremendous amount. Her memoir is out now. It's called Honoured. I think it actually is published tomorrow. I mean, I just run through a few of the things that she experienced. At the age of 12, she was sent to Pakistan. She thought she was going on holiday. It turned out to be something completely unexpected to her. She spent 3 years there and was tricked into a forced marriage with her cousin. When she came back to the UK, stuff continued to happen. Her mum was sentenced to 20 years in prison for murder. Naz was basically left to bring up her own siblings. At one point, she was homeless and had to sleep in a crack den. And she's been an MP since 2015. It is just quite remarkable what she's been able to achieve, bearing in mind everything she's been through. But she does say that, honestly, bringing together all her thoughts and her memories to write this book has actually been something that triggered PTSD, and she had to get help for a mental health crisis when she'd finished writing it, because I don't think she realised quite how much had happened to her, which I think is true of quite a few people who've been through all sorts of phenomenally tough experiences, that they're so busy trying to put one foot in front of another that they don't realise what it is they've gone through.
Until they go back and see it on the page.
Yeah, just remarkable. So Naz also talks very honestly, actually, about, well, things like cousin marriage and the fact that in Bradford, and she maintains it's still the case today, that certain parts of the community maintain a kind of stranglehold over running the place. And some leading councillors don't actually speak fluent English. And it's something that she has absolutely taken on. And you can imagine that she's made a few enemies along the way. But so she's really interesting to hear from. And that'll be at about 3:35.
Most read stories on the Times website so far today. Anthony Beaver: Trump shows signs of dementia. He can't be controlled. The best-selling historian says that the West is totally unprepared for the threat it faces It is well worth a read, that one. Up next, Pedro Sanchez says no to disastrous war after Trump threatens Spain. The Spanish Prime Minister is facing off with the US President. The Times' live page also has all of the latest details on the conflict in the Middle East. It has been constantly updated. And one story climbing the rankings very rapidly today. It's the arrest of three men in London and Wales on suspicion of spying for China. One of them is the partner of a Labour MP. The Security Minister, Dan Jarvis, updated MPs on the news in Parliament this afternoon.
Let me be clear. If there is proven evidence of attempts by China to interfere with UK sovereign affairs, we will impose severe consequences and hold all actors involved to account.
And you can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
You are with Times Radio. It's approaching 9 minutes past two. And some breaking news. The Royal Navy warship heading to Cyprus to protect it against attacks by Iran is not now going to depart until next week. You will know, of course, that RAF Akrotiri has been attacked several times by Iranian drones. This, of course, is HMS Dragon. I don't know what the explanation can be for that. Presumably some sort of technical difficulty, who knows? But it's not great news, is it, for the government? I don't think it's going to be the happiest day of Sir Keir Starmer's life, this one.
We will look into that and give you a few more details just as soon as we can.
Well, the Prime Minister has been speaking, of course, at PMQs today, and he said that 8 evacuation flights will leave the UAE for the UK today. Now, the PM made the announcement during what was a bad-tempered session of PMQs. He did clash repeatedly with Kemi Badenoch over defence spending and the UK's refusal to attack Iran alongside the US.
We're taking action to reduce the threat with planes in the sky in the region, intercepting incoming strikes, deploying more capability to Cyprus and allowing US planes to use UK bases to take out Iran's capability to strike. What I was not prepared to do on Saturday was for the UK to join a war unless I was satisfied there was a lawful basis and a viable thought-through plan. That remains my position.
That wasn't the question I asked him. Nobody wants to see an escalation. The fact is... Mr. Speaker, our bases, in case they don't realise, our bases have already been attacked. Iran is trying to kill our servicemen and women. He is catching arrows rather than stopping the archer. That's what we're talking about. Why is he asking our allies to do what we should be doing?
Kemi Badenoch up against Sir Keir Starmer today. Well, let's bring in James Nation, who is deputy head of Rishi Sunak's Downing Street policy unit. The session today was, and we often say fiery, but this was a world beyond fiery, I think. James, what did you make of it?
Yeah, it was quite difficult to watch. I mean, I know there's a lot going on in the world. Very febrile environment. It feels like febrile is the word of the day at the moment in Westminster. And you could clearly feel the tension in the chamber. I think if I was to be fair to both sides really quickly, I'd say Keir Starmer as Prime Minister has very difficult judgments given the exposure of UK assets in the Middle East and what's going on in Iran. But I think Kemi Badenoch has fair questions to challenge him on when it comes to UK capabilities, which we've just seen with your breaking story now on delays around the warship deployment to protect RAF Akrotiri. So if I was being fair, I think that's what both sides were trying to get at. But the exchanges and the temper did get a little heated.
Yeah, well, you don't need to be fair. You can just tell us, James, what you really think, to be honest. I mean, Kemi Badenoch got off to a slow start as opposition leader. There's no doubt about that. She is increasingly having the upper hand in these exchanges, isn't she? Would that be the case today, do you think?
Yeah, look, my view is certainly she is making the weather or has been making the weather in Westminster. Or certainly when it comes to Prime Minister's questions and doing a very good and effective job, actually, as leader of the opposition in the House of Commons. I think today, like I say, very fair attacks on defence spending. But I do think you have to say as well, the Prime Minister has difficult judgments that maybe Mark Carney, Friedrich Merz, other global leaders don't have. when it comes to kind of the UK's exposure in the Middle East.
Okay.
And that's why making sure that we have protection in place there is vital.
Yeah, I mean, some people have said, why can't he be as forthright as those Western leaders have been? You're saying there is an explanation and he's in an almost impossible situation, Sir Keir Starmer.
Yeah, he's chosen a particular interpretation of international law off the back of advice from the Attorney General. But I think, yes, it is fair to say that there are ways that this could escalate that could be more concerning and damaging from a British perspective than what the Canadians and the Germans, for example, have to deal with. But it all depends on, are we actually able to defend ourselves? And the worrying scenario is, what would happen if we were to see another attack or a drone strike get through on RAF Akrotiri in particular? I think that would lead to a very troubling scenario and situation, and it would leave the government exposed with current debates on defence spending as well.
I've got to say the listeners are unimpressed by that news about HMS Dragon. Starmer and his cronies are simply not up to the job, says one listener. HMS Dragon won't go until next week. What a joke. Starmer should resign. He's utterly hopeless. I could lend the Royal Navy a powerful set of jump leads if they think they might help. I mean, you can laugh, but actually this is making us look a bit ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it is not good optics at all that when the Prime Minister has read out a range of activity that we're undertaking that hinges on, yes, the deployment of the warship, but also all of the capabilities and operations that we're going to need to stand up to support expats out in some of the neighbouring countries as well. You know, I've seen this before. When something like this goes wrong or the British government can't execute an operational plan effectively, it definitely does raise the temperature and risk politicians not looking great. So I'm not surprised by the reaction at all, particularly given what we're only an hour or so from when this was majored on at the dispatch box by the Prime Minister.
Let's hear a little bit more about what went on. Here's Kemi Badenoch drawing that clear line that she's so keen to emphasise between defence spending and welfare spending.
Yesterday, the Chancellor could have given more money to defence. Yeah. Instead, I don't know why they're laughing. I don't know why that's funny. Yes, not funny. Yesterday, the Chancellor could have given more money to defence. Instead, she gave more money for welfare. Their priorities are all wrong, Mr. Speaker. Their priorities are all wrong. They can chunter as much as they like. The fact of the matter is that the war in Iran is happening now.
Yes. Is it fair to say that the Chancellor gave more money to welfare yesterday?
Yes, I think it is, because in the assumptions that the Treasury will have given to the Office for Budget Responsibility, they're assuming, or the government is effectively signing off, a big projected increase in what we spend on benefits overall. And what you've not got is a corresponding plan for ramping up defence expenditure. We don't know when that will come. There are a lot of assumptions yesterday that were delayed over what particular plans are going to be for departmental spending, including defence. And I think it's difficult to see in this scenario how the government's current line, which is basically holding defence spending as a share of GDP flat after 2027, how that's going to hold. So I think, yes, if you're looking at the plans that were published yesterday, you've got a projected increase on welfare that government policy isn't addressing, and you've not yet got a policy over and above the current situation on defence.
This, of course, it's worth emphasising that your old boss, Rishi Sunak, he promised to raise defence spending to 2.5% by 2030. Starmer says he'll hit the target by next year, may get to 3% by 2030. The money has to come from somewhere. I mean, it's one of the oldest lines in the book. Where is the money going to come from? So what would you do if you were advising your old boss about how he could find the money and where he could find it? What would you say?
Look, I don't want to be flippant about this because the trade-offs are very difficult, but I think you do have to level with the country for some difficult decisions on the welfare side and around changing eligibility and entitlements, and to actually make an argument as to why that needs to happen in order to free up resources for defence. I think that is the obvious switch to make. I think towards the end of our time, we looked at levers such as cutting the size of the civil service, but then you always find a lag with that, with those kind of plans delivering or not. So I think an undeniable undeniably hard decision is required here. And I would particularly look at the welfare side, given what's happened to that budget following on from the pandemic. And then just one thing, if I may, on defence really quickly, because I think it's really important and listeners will appreciate this. It's one of those areas where we focus on an input target, on spend as a share of GDP, because that's just the way it's been done. But actually, a lot of this also depends on our ability to procure equipment effectively, to actually being able to deploy resources effectively as well. And that's also part of the equation here that doesn't often get focused on, because it's always you need to find more resources, which you do. But you also need to be able to have a plan to deploy those effectively and procure the equipment you need.
Now, in the interest of fairness, I need to bring in the listeners again. Some are pointing out that it was the Tories that cut defence spending. And that's undeniable, isn't it?
Yeah, over the full suite of the Conservatives being in office from 2010, there were reductions in defence. There were then significant uplifts when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, under us as well. You know, I could equally go back and we could look at something like the aircraft carrier decisions under the last Labour government. The point is, this is something where I think successive governments over decades have let kind of defence spending fall as a result of this quote unquote peace dividend. And now there is a need to turn the situation around urgently. And that is proving very difficult, because the sums required do require really hard trade-offs that I think the public need to accept as well. You know, if we're talking about getting to 3% of GDP on defence, that is a massive tens of billions increase per annum. And you can either get that through tax, which I don't think the public would support, or you can get it through difficult cuts and decisions elsewhere. And I think what's required now is whomever was in power, in fairness, to actually just level and make an argument over a difficult trade-off and what decision they're going to make.
Now, it's not an easy time to be the British Prime Minister, because you have to dedicate an enormous amount of time to wrangling the President of the United States. It's just as simple as that.
Yes.
And there is an article in the Times today by the renowned historian Anthony Beaver, who very frankly suggests that Trump is showing signs of dementia. Now, he's not the first person to have suggested that. Members of Trump's own family have certainly more than hinted at it. If that is true, how on earth does a British Prime Minister navigate these sorts of situations?
Look, I think regardless of whether or not that specifically is true, you're dealing with someone who is an erratic character, who says one thing, does another. You know, you could quite foreseeably imagine a scenario where, yes, the Oval Office comments were stark, but you could also see if the King goes for the 250th anniversary, you could quite easily see him being effusive about the UK again in a few weeks. You just don't know. And you have all of these noises off on trade, tariffs. What a start to the year we've had. All you can really do, I think, is you just have to trust that, unfortunately, or for better or worse, our integration with the American system on several key features, whether that's trade or defence, requires our respective states and establishments to maintain those deep ties. It gets very difficult when you have difficult relationships at the top, difficult comments at the top, like what we've seen. But I think the idea that we can call time on the special relationship today and pivot is just not a realistic assessment of where the UK is in the world.
Thank you. That's interesting. James Nation, former deputy head of policy to Rishi Sunak when Mr. Sunak was in Downing Street. James is now the MD of Forefront Advisors.
So a lot of you are rightly quite angry about everything that's going on at the moment, and that anger is fired off in quite different directions. But here are two rather similar points of view. This one comes in from Michael, who says, I'm ex-forces. The situation worries me. It worries me so much, excuse me, my screen just jumped, that I'm prepared to pay more tax for defence only. The welfare sponge brigade should also be prepared to lose some of their free money. I challenge these freeloaders to agree. And Andy says, one in five new cars purchased in the UK are using Motability. This could be reduced vastly. And I suspect that you're trying to hypothecate a certain amount of money towards defence. We will carry on talking about this throughout the afternoon, and also we'll try and bring you just a little bit more detail on why there is now going to be this delay to HMS Dragon leaving Portsmouth. It is currently being loaded up. It was expected to sail immediately, but now the news is it's not going to sail until next week. Destination, Akrotiri. Coming up, Louis Sarkozy, son of the former French President Nicolas, is running for mayor. Is this the start of a new political dynasty? Forgive my pronunciation, I've got a cold. It's Jane and Fee, it's always rubbish, on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
My goodness, there's an awful lot going on. We'll be live as ever from 6 o'clock, bringing you the latest from the Middle East and elsewhere as the conflict continues.
From nine, we'll make sense of the world with the Times columnists Fraser Nelson and Cindy Yu. And of course, we'll get the best letters to the Times this week with Andrew Riley. Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from six on Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
Now, legalising drugs and banning traffic lights, if you believe in those things, then you may have someone to vote for, and it's not the Green Party. Nicolas Sarkozy's son Louis is running for mayor of the French town of Menton. In a past life as a political commentator, the 28-year-old called for the legalisation of all drugs and the abolition of traffic lights. I don't think you want to do those two things at the same time. He's the same age as his dad when he launched his political career and says if he wins, he would like to go on to become president. Times contributor Adam Sage has been getting the mood and joins us now from Paris. I'm sorry if I've pronounced the French town of Menton incorrectly.
Menton. Yeah, Menton.
Okay, we'll stick with Menton. Tell us a little bit more about Louis.
Well, Louis, yes, well, he's 28. This is exactly the same age as his father, Nicolas Sarkozy, when he launched his career, became mayor of Neuilly-sur-Seine, which is a wealthy Parisian suburb. He's trying to emulate him in Menton, in the French Riviera. But it's an uphill battle, and it's going to be a struggle for him to win those mayoral elections there. And possibly to go on to have the same career as his father, who was several times minister and then president.
Some of his ideas are a little bit eye-catching, Adam. Can you tell us more about what's in his manifesto?
Yes, well, I mean, I think we have to separate him as a political commentator. I mean, he lived quite a lot of his life in the United States, so I don't know if that explains some of his more wacky ideas or not, really. Perhaps. He lived in the United States because his mother, Cecilia Attias, divorced from or left Nicolas Sarkozy very, very soon after becoming French First Lady. And so she moved across the Atlantic, and so he grew up with her there. He speaks very good English. He came back to France a couple of years ago with his American wife, and with whom he now has a baby, a 5-month-old baby, and became a political commentator and started a whole series of pretty eye-catching ideas. As you say, there's the traffic lights. I mean, he says he's a liberal, so I mean, the fewer laws, the better, really, is what his point of view.
But Adam, you can be liberal and still want people to slow down at a junction.
yeah. Well, well, I mean, he'd say that they'd slow down spontaneously. I mean, there is an argument. To be fair to him, and some towns, I think across Europe, have got rid of traffic lights. I would very much hesitate to do it in France, where I don't think anyone would slow down at all, really.
I mean, it's easy to laugh at things like that, but actually, does the guy have enough to convince people that he is, you know, a serious contender for the future?
Well, he has the backing in Menton of several mainstream political parties now. Including the Republicans, which was his father's party. Now, when Nicolas Sarkozy launched his career, the Republicans were rather like the Conservative Party in the UK, a very dominant force. And if you were picked as the Republican candidate in any particular town, you had a very good chance of winning. Things have significantly changed since then. Rather like the UK, the Republicans are really a sort of rump of what they used to be, and running much, much far behind behind nationally, far behind the populist right national rally. And it's exactly the same in the town of Menton, where despite the backing of what are called in France the parties of government, Nicolas Sarkozy is on about 16 or 17%, according to polls, whereas his national rally rival is on about 31% and very well placed to win. So I think, is he a serious candidate? He liked to be thought of as a serious candidate. He may become a serious candidate one day. I think that his supporters would say he's a serious candidate now. It would be a surprise if he won in the current political climate in France.
Obviously, his father has had a slightly turbulent career in politics, I mean, notably of late. So when Louis is asked about him, what does he say?
Well, I mean, he says he's one of the greatest, he told me he's one of the greatest political figures of the 20th and 21st centuries in France, and talked about him in the same breath as Napoleon and Churchill. Now, I mean, it's true that Nicolas Sarkozy does have a lot of admirers still, despite, as you say, as you very euphemistically said, of a pretty turbulent time, which included going to prison fairly recently. He's sentenced for corruption three times, the third of which over the alleged receipt of Libyan funding from Muammar Gaddafi he's appealing against. So his standing in France, where, I mean, even if he has a lot of supporters, and including his son, his standing has waned a little bit in recent times following all those convictions.
And how does the French electorate view nepotism in general?
There are several political dynasties in France, of course. President Mitterrand, who was president in the 1980s, at least one of his sons went on to become mayor in the southwest. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who was president before him, his children went into politics. So, there are many, many political dynasties in France. French people would tell you, of course, if you ask them the question like that, is nepotism a good thing or a bad thing? They say it's a bad thing. But in practice, people do vote for the sons of former politicians. So I don't think that is necessarily a bar for Louis Sarkozy winning in Menton. What is more of a problem for him is that he's viewed as an outsider, an American, but even worse, as perhaps as a Parisian, really. And that's the real tag that he has to shake off, rather than being the son of a former president.
Adam, thank you very much indeed. That is Adam Sage reporting from Paris. I mean, the nepotism in politics is extraordinary when you just glance around the world at the moment, because obviously in the court of President Trump, there are quite a few of his own family in operation.
Yes. Oh, and his son-in-law.
Just when you look at the Ayatollah's regime, it is his son who is one of the contenders to replace him. It's pretty much everywhere. Do you wish for your children to follow in your footsteps,
Jane? I very
John?
Much hope that in 30 years' time, your daughter and one of mine are sitting right here. That's exactly how it should be.
Lucky them.
Yes.
Lucky you, listeners.
Yes, aren't you lucky? Some really interesting messages from you today. Please keep them coming. 0333 003 2353. The Times is reporting it could be a fortnight before HMS Dragon is actually in place to protect Cyprus. There will be more now on Times Radio in the form of their news headlines. And here is Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The US Defence Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship off Sri Lanka. Pete Hegseth says it's the first sinking of an enemy ship by a torpedo since World War II. Sri Lanka's Deputy Foreign Minister says at least 80 people were killed in the Indian Ocean attack. Hegseth has been updating reporters on the progress of the conflict against the Iranian regime.
We have only just begun to hunt, dismantle, demoralize, destroy, and defeat their capabilities just 4 days in. Starting last night and to be completed in a few days, in under a week, the two most powerful air forces in the world will have complete control of Iranian skies, uncontested airspace.
It's reported that HMS Dragon will not leave the UK for Cyprus until next week. Sky News says the Type 45 destroyer, currently moored in Portsmouth Harbour, is being loaded with ammunition before sailing for the Mediterranean. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. The Met Police says the suspects, 39, 43 and 68, were arrested by counter-terror officers in London and Wales after being accused of assisting a foreign intelligence service. The Guardian says one of them is the partner of a sitting Labour MP. And the government has launched a review to tackle anti-Semitism in schools and colleges. Anti-Semitic incidents related to education are double pre-2023 levels. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
This Mother's Day, there's a Moonpig for every kind of mum. Like the mum who's you rock through every high and low. The nan who always has time for a cuppa. Or the mummy who's there for cuddles and the chaos. So add stickers, handwriting and photos to the UK's most personalised card. Plus get 20% off with code MUM20. Because this Mother's Day, everyone deserves a
Moonpig.com.
To verify, see moonpig.com/personalised.
The to-do list. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, I mentioned that your messages had been coming in thick and fast today. Domingo says the continuous back and forth between Labour and Tories as to who's to blame for the reduction in defence spending isn't helpful. Labour are the government of the day. It is their decision. And from Robert, there's so much obfuscation and smoke and mirrors by the government when it comes to talk about defence spending. It's important to understand that the money needed is not just about new equipment. It's about bringing existing resources up to operational capability. We have highly technical nuclear-powered subs that require routine maintenance, but there's no capacity in the system to overhaul them. The last two routine nuclear missile test launches failed. Frigates are being laid off before the replacement is ready. There are insufficient sailors to crew the ships on rotation. This is just scraping the surface. Well, I'm assuming, Robert, that you have inside knowledge there. It sounds like it, doesn't it?
It does. And let's just give a nod to Mike. We were talking about political nepotism, and Mike says, just think of the Kinnocks. How much have they cost us? I don't know. Do you have a figure, Mike? If you do, it's 0333 003 2353. What?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't necessarily put the Kinnocks up there with, you know, the son of an Ayatollah. I mean, I think it's a bit unfair.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a reasonable comparison.
Or the Gaddafis. So, John Pienaar will take over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So much to talk about. Where do we even start today?
Well, start with just a catch-up on where we are with the news of three men being arrested on suspicion of spying for China, including apparently the partner of an MP. So we'll hear whatever is latest on that breaking story. And some other, you know, as it were, new, fresh, really big questions. Today, you saw question time, and there was Keir Starmer getting cheered, you know, pretty loudly by his own side. Now, that's nothing very new. That's their job at 12 o'clock on a Wednesday, right? It's question time. But it did seem that they actually meant it. And it may be, I just wonder, whether the Prime Minister falling out as loudly as he has with Donald Trump might just help him here at home. Yes, with public opinion, which doesn't love Donald Trump and doesn't love the war in Iran. But maybe also with his own side, will it help him in some way to stave off the threat to his leadership as that threat sort of keeps on looming large? So I'm going to be talking about that. And another, even as a broader and bigger question, which is, has the immediate row with Donald Trump, but also the Iran war and the questions that has thrown up, has it just forced us to have a conversation about whether or not we are in Britain the major power that we'd like to think we are? And sort of see and take that status, as it were, for granted. I think so many question marks over that now, which need to be addressed, and we'll be addressing them. So I'll be talking to, among others, a former British Army general. I'll talk to a former National Security Advisor. I'm going to be actually doing a bit of a bounce around the Gulf states to see where they are at this moment, because they've got different perspectives, and just try and explore that a little bit. And also Israel, where there's talk of a much quicker election than people might have expected. Where is that going and what might that all mean too? So a really busy show.
Very busy. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Don't miss a moment here on Times Radio.
Now, we know that US forces are fighting in the skies over Iran, but it's not the only country on Donald Trump's list. Speaking last week, next to his ever-present helicopter, the US president suggested that Cuba was also in his sights.
We could very well end up having a friendly takeover of Cuba. After many, many years, we've had a lot of years of dealing with Cuba. I've been hearing about Cuba since I'm a little boy, but they're in big trouble, and we could very well, something good, I think very positive for the people that were expelled or worse from Cuba that live here. You know, we have people living here that want to go back to Cuba.
Donald Trump, I don't know why I have to tell you that's Donald Trump, I think you probably knew. This comes after the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro was seized by US commandos at the very start of this year, which feels like a lifetime ago. Stephen Gibbs is the Latin America correspondent for The Times, and he joins us now from Venezuela. Well, we'll talk about Venezuela in a minute, another story that it has somewhat slipped away, but let's talk about Cuba. What are the chances of this so-called friendly takeover? What do you think, Stephen?
Well, Cuba is in as serious trouble probably as it has been since the collapse of its benefactor, the Soviet Union, in the late 90s. And a lot of that most recently is directly due to what President Trump has been doing since January, as you say, with the capture of Maduro in Venezuela. Venezuela was providing around almost 60% of Cuba's oil requirements. Now, that has been cut off, and also Trump has stopped or threatened to sanction any country that sends oil to Cuba. So it's a country that, although it has some of its own domestic production, it's being seriously strangled. So there is an opportunity from the United States' point of view to really push Cuba into a corner and make it make a deal. But how you get from A to B is the big unknown. There's no doubt real weakness, and the government there is unpopular, particularly the president. But, you know, how you actually turn that from, as Trump says, you know, a sort of friendly takeover is a big mystery at the moment.
There have been talks, haven't there, quite recently in Mexico between Cuban and US officials?
Well, these have never been completely confirmed. The United States, Trump particularly, and Rubio, they keep saying, we are talking to Cuba, we are talking to the senior leadership. That is actually denied by Cuba. It says we've exchanged messages, but it insists that there are no negotiations. Why does it say that? Well, Cuba has this sort of long-term position that it will only sit down and negotiate from a position of two equals, from a position of total sovereign respect between the two countries. Now, some point out that under Trump, the game has completely changed. This idea that you have mutual respect is not really the way he rolls. Now, what the United States is saying is that it is talking, or it's indicating that it's talking to members of the Castro family. Raul Castro was the last president of Cuba. It's currently Miguel Díaz-Canel. But he is the sort of Ayatollah figure in many ways, in it sitting in the background. So what the US is saying is that it's been talking to a grandson of Raul Castro, but the Cubans do not confirm that. It is quite possible, and it's been sort of widely reported, that this is a sort of back door that the United States is trying to open, effectively going behind the political leadership in Cuba.
Now, it's not exactly a barrel of laughs living in Cuba right now, is it? So, I mean, there's the fuel embargo. Inflation is, I mean, we always use the word rampant, don't we? But it's pretty tough to live there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people I speak to in Cuba say, as I say, this is those who remember the special period, as it was called, after the fall of the Soviet Union, say it is as bad or worse than that. The key problem is power cuts. Because of this lack of fuel, there's a lack of fuel to provide power. So the electricity is off more than it's on. And that is a real problem in a tropical island. So your fans don't work, your freezer doesn't work, your fridge doesn't work. And then more recently, this total lack of gasoline means that no one can get anywhere. So it feels paralyzed, everyone says. And there are people in Cuba, you know, this is a a country that has a sort of strong sort of nationalistic streak, but there are definitely there's a constituency there thinking, well, whatever can change here is going to be better than what we have yet. So again, that's this window of opportunity that the United States sort of spied and feels that, you know, this is an opportunity again.
But the Cuban leadership is presumably looking at Iran, and I appreciate that actually none of us know really what is going on inside Iran, but we can gauge it must be pretty unpleasant for the citizens, and they must be petrified. Do they think they can perhaps by negotiation fend this kind of series of attacks off?
Yeah, I think there are many consequences of what's going on in Iran for Cuba. One is, yeah, this possibility that we're next. That said, I think it's very unlikely that a serious military assault on Cuba is possible. Another theory is that if the United States ends up in something of a quagmire in Iran, that might make this whole sort of domino effect that it was going to be Venezuela, then Iran, then Cuba, that might bring that to a halt. There may be a chance that the US thinks, right, we need to be a bit more careful here about trying to pull off a Venezuela in other countries because it's proving so complicated.
Well, you're in Venezuela. It has slipped from the headlines. What is life like there?
Well, I mean, this has been the most extraordinary situation where you have a leader that the leadership around him was sort of declaring loyalty and saying, you know, that nothing will change and that he is the man that we respect. He's removed. And, you know, within a few days, they are doing really what the United States did. And there is this sort of sea change in this country, a degree of optimism about a possibly more prosperous future, but also a degree of feeling, wait a sec, how much has everything changed? Because the vice president under Maduro is now acting as the president. And so the sort of personnel of this country hasn't changed, but the key leading figure, the former president Maduro, is out. And sort of life goes on, a very surreal situation. And again, I think there's a risk that people look at, or certainly the Trump administration looks at what happened in Venezuela and says, right, maybe we can pull this off in other places, in Iran. You know, Trump has even said, you know, or suggested that he is looking for a Delcy Rodriguez, the vice president, who's now the president of Venezuela, in Iran or in Cuba. But Venezuela, it may be the sort of exception that proves the rule. Let's see.
Yeah, well, how much has Rodriguez had to change in order to adapt to her new circumstances?
Well, I mean, she's had to accept that the United States is now taking this sort of supervisory role over the entire oil industry of Venezuela. Oil is by far the most important export of Venezuela. Every sale is now sort of administered by the United States. And one consequence of that is they're saying absolutely no deliveries at all to Cuba. She's adapting to it by showing this remarkable ability to sort of give two versions of the same story. So to the Americans, she's extremely cooperative. Trump has repeatedly praised, you know, how efficient and how helpful she is. But to the domestic audience, you know, she still gives these speeches of saying we are a sovereign country. We're not going to be dominated by anyone. You know, the removal of Maduro was a disgrace, etc. So a very sort of effective double take on this is what she's doing. What she's not being forced to do is change massively the personnel around her. And that might be the problem, the sort of stick that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. So the United States, I think both sides are sort of pretending this is a slightly different picture than it really is. Mm. You know, Venezuela is not run by the United States, but at the same time, you know, the United States is taking this very important role in the key industry.
Right. And anyway, Trump's moved on. He's not really interested. I mean, well, you tell me, is he interested in Venezuela anymore, or his thoughts for the moment focused elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely focused elsewhere, but given any opportunity to mention Venezuela, he sort of says, what a great country, what a great success we're having down there. So he doesn't want to see a sort of disaster unfold here. But yes, I mean, I think there's no question that he called victory quite early on this one, but he's still focusing on it. And there's actually there's an expectation that there'll be an a senior government, US government visit here in the next few days. So he's not abandoning this project, but he's definitely got his focus elsewhere.
Quick question from a listener in Norfolk. Anne says, can you ask your guest if he knows what Trump's plans are for Maduro and his wife? Well, they're in custody, aren't they, still?
Yeah, it's not really Trump's plans anymore. It's US justice. The 26th of March, we're hearing, will be the next appearance of Maduro and his wife in a court in the United States, in New York, and then we'll see how that trial goes.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Stephen Gibbs, who's the Latin America correspondent for The Times. He was actually in Venezuela, talking initially about Cuba, and a number of people have pointed out, of course, that Marco Rubio is of Cuban heritage, so he feels a real keen interest, shall we say, more than that, in doing something about Cuba. That would seem to be the case. And it's also right to say that the Foreign Office here does advise against travel to Cuba right now.
Now, a little bit more information for you on the story that has been breaking over the last couple of hours. The Times reports it could now be 2 weeks before HMS Dragon is in place to protect Cyprus from ballistic missiles and drone attacks. Officials say the Type 45 destroyer won't set sail until next week. It's being brought out of maintenance and fitted with the right weapons. It'll then take between 5 and 7 days to reach Cyprus. One official said the proposal to send the ship didn't cross the desk of the Chief of Defence Staff until 9:30 on Tuesday morning, 4 days after the war started and nearly 2 days since RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus was hit by drones. He passed the proposal to ministers and then a decision was made shortly after that. More as we get it. Coming up, a change of direction for the last quarter of an hour of this programme before the 3 o'clock news. Could handcuffed, last pair standing, be the new traitors? Simple answer is no. But we will talk about it a little bit more with Scott Bryan. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio, hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio. With the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme, you could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Turn ordinary into the extraordinary every day with the Lexus LBX. Whilst most SUVs are big and brash, the LBX is quietly bold and confident. Refined luxury crafted into a compact SUV. The Lexus LBX, What Car's Best Small SUV 2024 and 2025.
I thought I'd seen it all, then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So I don't know whether you've seen the advertisements for Jonathan Ross's new vehicle. It's this extraordinary television show called Handcuffed, Last Pair Standing, where unlikely couples are handcuffed together, and the people who get to the end of the experiment, and they really do have to do everything together, they win a substantial prize. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments' time with our TV critic Scott Bryan, but we're going to start with something very, very sensible indeed, Scott, which is whether or not children's programming has gone downhill. That's the gist of it, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, the head of children's BBC, their boss, has basically sort of highlighted a difficulty within the industry at the moment, saying that rivals are just not invested in making kids programming anymore. And I think it's noticeable. I mean, you only have to think about 2 decades ago how regular it would be to have the CITV stint on ITV, plus also BBC having programmes between 3:25 and 5:30. You were either a BBC kid or a CITV kid. I was definitely a BBC kid. And of course, there's been a lot of change within that time. I think most notably, the junk food ban that's been put in place has hit revenues, because those junk food advertisements, whether you're for or against the ban, would be aimed at young kids, bringing in a substantial amount of income for those broadcasters. Plus, also at the same time, you've got quite a lot of kids now who, of course, are not watching linear TV altogether. There's been a significant drop in the number of young viewers who are watching children's TV. And I think there's a general concern within the industry about whether they're having shows that are informative and educational, you know, in the vein of Blue Peter, or whether they're just being served slop. Yeah,
but Scott, isn't this exactly what the BBC should be doing as the nation's public service broadcaster funded by the people? And actually, you know, commercial channels are driven by commerce. They don't have to do that. Why should the BBC complain about this?
Well, I think the BBC is still one of the biggest payers of content, still substantially. I mean, they are still, you know, they've still got two dedicated channels for it. But you have to state the economic facts of it. I mean, just in the last week, Tim Davie has announced that the Director General has announced another sort of £300 million or so pounds worth of cuts. And that is purely because of the amount of people who are no longer paying for their licence fee. If the BBC is not having the income, they're not able to make the programmes. It's as simple as that. And I think if you look at the wider market, streaming services just don't really make specific kids content. You know, if you look on Netflix, they might have the odd programme or maybe massive hit like K-pop Demon Hunters, but they aren't necessarily making the types of educational shows because they're not under Ofcom jurisdiction, that they have to provide so many hours worth of kids content throughout the year, whilst public service broadcasters in the UK do. And I think it's just the fact that the way that TV is being made at the moment, there's been a real emphasis on fewer programmes and maybe spending more on them, whilst I think kids programmes are very much you know, cheaper and studio-based, but are the first programmes to get cut because they're just not seen to be a priority.
And we won't really actually know what we have lost until they've gone and a whole generation of kids have been brought up on slop. Because often the messaging is quite kind of subtle, isn't it, but profound in kids' TV programmes. But it may have done us all some good as we ingest it. A quick look back at the Brits with you, please. Scott, your thoughts on it all, your thoughts on the jokes. How did it compare to the BAFTAs?
Well, I mean, I found the Brits interesting. I found it was a really good idea to have it out of London. I found the Co-op Arena made it a much better spectacle for television. It looks amazing in there. And I found the performances, such as from Harry Styles, you only have to go onto social media to see how many people are still talking about it 3 days on or 4 days on. The ratings did take a hit. It's some of the lowest again in recent years. The move to Saturday from Wednesday has been, I think, noticeable in terms of the decline of viewership when ITV had planned it to actually go the other way, hoping it would have a boost. Plus, on the other hand, a lot of people are sharing clips on social media, so maybe that's not the most important metric anymore. I think the biggest sort of outcome of the evening for me is that they seem to use more bleeps than actually hand out awards. Of course, it's a live programme. There's a slight tape delay, but they were even bleeping Jack Whitehall's jokes after the watershed, which I just found to be totally baffling. I know that, of course, a lot of kids are watching because I think kids stay up late specifically to watch it. But if you're trying to market yourself as this kind of out of control music night and anything can happen, if you don't show what actually is happening, then that could be actually a problem.
Yeah, I would agree with you about that. But also, it kind of doesn't matter in the long run anymore, Scott, does it? Because you can just go online and find out what the jokes were, because people just
literally what I was doing.
Yeah, so it's quite a good fun after show game. Let's talk now then about this extraordinary programme, Handcuffed, Last Pair Standing, which is on Channel 4, fronted by Jonathan Ross. Just explain the concept of it, Scott.
Well, the word extraordinary is certainly a word to describe this programme. I mean, I think it feels as if we're going back to 2005 when Channel 4 was throwing together social experiments. Basically, I mean, saying it is a social experiment when actually it's just a form of entertainment and having people yell at each other. So they pair together complete opposites. So maybe someone who goes to the gym every single day and finds the gym a part of their life, they are handcuffed to somebody who doesn't go to the gym at all. You might have somebody who... you know, says the word darling and babe in everyday conversation with somebody handcuffed to who does not like those terms or phrases being used at all, etc., 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 blah, blah, blah. It's just, I mean, I found it remarkably, firstly, dull as a concept. I was like, who cares? I don't care about these people really, per se. I mean, the whole idea is a social experiment when it actually it seems to be whoever has the handcuff on the longest ends up being the winner of the money. So they could hate each other and still handcuff each other a long time ago. But it also just feels as from a different age. You know, it feels from like it's from the wife swap age of people from polarizing views being made to live together, or in the Channel 4 age of social experiments where you have to keep people awake for the longest physical time possible, or pretend to send people off to space when they aren't going to space. Those were shows that actually had happened. I'm not sure whether the ratings, firstly, have really captured the public's imagination. I think it's a show that I would not like to get handcuffed to myself.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I just think it sounds daft. I think you'd dip into it for 5 minutes just to see how daft it is and then switch off. I'm quite interested in the one where people were sent to space but weren't actually sent to space. When was that?
It was in, it's called Space Cadets. There's a great podcast, I forgot the name, but I think you can just search for it. And there's a series where they speak to the people involved. They basically said that they were in going into space, but they were going to be close enough to the Earth's gravity where they would have near enough gravity. So fooling them and thinking when they were in space, they actually weren't. And then also they said they were flying them to Russia to take them to space when actually they were just flying around in circles, I think around Essex for like 4 or 5 hours, and then landed only a few miles away from where they started. You can imagine it's not a show I think you can make today because of the psychological ramifications of it. It was very much from a different era.
Yeah, I'm going to look that one up. It sounds absolutely terrific. Scott, thank you very much indeed. We'll save a discussion about Leo Woodall in Vladimir until next week.
But we will watch it
yes. For research purposes. Yes, very much so, Jane. Yes, thank you, Scott. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Scott. Min asks, how much of a big cash prize would you two expect to be offered if you were handcuffed together on a UK road trip? I think 10 million.
I'm going to go higher.
Just very cool. Right. Good afternoon. We're heading to the difficult 3 o'clock in the afternoon period. Stick with us.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. And in the next hour, former UK ambassador to Washington, Kim Darroch, will give us his reaction to the events in the Middle East, and he'll assess the state of the USA-UK relationship, or lack of it, right now. We'll talk sport with Vassos Alexander today, a coach's challenge, yet another way to complicate VAR. And our big guest after 3:30 is the Labour MP Naz Shah on her memoir, Honoured. Now, she has been through a forced marriage, she's been homeless, her mother got a life sentence for murder. She's not your average parliamentarian. You'll hear from Naz after 3:30. Here's the news, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The US Defence Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship off Sri Lanka. Pete Hegseth says it's the first sinking of an enemy ship by a torpedo since World War II. Sri Lanka's Deputy Foreign Minister says at least 80 people were killed in the Indian Ocean attack. Hegseth says the US and Israel will soon have complete control of Iranian airspace.
It means we will fly all day, all night, day and night, finding, fixing, and finishing the missiles and defense industrial base of the Iranian military, finding and fixing their leaders and their military leaders, flying over Tehran, flying over Iran, flying over their capital, flying over the IRGC, Iranian leaders looking up and seeing only U.S. and Israeli air power.
Iranian media says Tehran will target Israeli embassies worldwide if Israel attacks the Iranian embassy in Beirut. That's attributed to an Iranian armed forces spokesman. The IDF says it's begun a wave of strikes in southern Lebanon. Sir Keir Starmer says the special relationship with the US is not about hanging on to President Trump's latest words. He says that British jets shooting down drones and missiles to protect American lives demonstrates the special relationship. Trump has said that Starmer is no Churchill. The leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, has given his reaction.
To say he's no Churchill is quite an understatement, really, I would have thought. I mean, the man has dithered. He's all over the place. He's not a leader. He's a follower. His performance has been abject over the course of the last few days, added to which we haven't even got a Royal Navy that's serviceable anymore. So I'm not surprised he said what he said.
The partner of a Labour MP has been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. David Taylor, a lobbyist married to Joni Reid, was one of three men arrested in London and Wales on suspicion of assisting a foreign intelligence service. Reid says she's never seen anything that made her suspect her husband had broken the law. Security Minister Dan Jarvis has been updating the Commons.
I can confirm that this relates to China. I can also confirm that this relates to foreign interference targeting UK democracy. Mr. Speaker, for reasons that you will understand, it would not be appropriate for me to comment on any aspect of what is now a live investigation. It is absolutely critical that we do not hamper the work of the police or prejudice any future legal processes by what we say in this House today.
The government has launched a review to tackle anti-Semitism in schools and colleges. Anti-Semitic incidents related to education are double pre-2023 levels. And Luke Donald will captain Europe's Ryder Cup team at Adair Manor in Limerick in 2027. He's aiming to make history by winning three tournaments in a row. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Welcome aboard. It's 4 minutes past three. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We've got a fascinating interview after 3:30 with the Labour MP, Naz Shah. Her journey through life is incredible. The type of things that she has had to face and do are extraordinary. Perhaps you feel those are superlatives that you hear ahead of most interviews, but honestly, they are truly deserved in this instance. We are also going to talk about sport and the dreaded VAR with Vassos Alexander in this half an hour of the programme too. Just a couple of thoughts from the last hour. Nick says, bring back Watch with Mother. Now, I didn't know there was a Watch with Mother. I thought there was only a Listen with Mother.
No, Watch with Mother. I think on the whole, it was a different show every day, and I used to dread the days when it was Andy Pandy.
Oh, okay.
Andy,
so it was a kind of vehicle into which other things were put.
They were inserted.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was on at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
And would that have been on the BBC?
Yes, it was.
It was. Okay. It wasn't on the other vulgar channel.
No.
And this one coming in from Janie, who says, we're handcuffed together, but isn't that just marriage? Well, Janie, I hope you're having a nice afternoon, love, and you've got some break time, a little bit of me time coming up later. Now, here's some serious business. It just is serious at the moment, isn't it? Last night, President Trump dismissed Keir Starmer as no Churchill. The bond between the UK and the US, once touted as Keir Starmer's strength, is looking very strained at the moment over Iran, but also over the Chagos Islands. At PMQs this afternoon, Keir Starmer defended his idea of that special relationship.
British jets are shooting down drones and missiles to protect American lives in the Middle East on our joint bases. That is the special relationship in action. Hanging on to President Trump's latest words is not the special relationship.
Well, King Charles is supposed to be travelling to the US for a three-day visit in April, but can that really happen while the US president wages war abroad and disparages our Prime Minister? Let's talk about all of this with Lord Darroch, former UK ambassador to the US. Kim Darroch, Lord Darroch, a very good afternoon from us. Gosh, we have got so much to talk about. We're going to park the King for just a couple of moments and start, if we may, by talking about what Keir Starmer said at PMQs. And his defence of his position is just incredibly difficult at the moment, isn't it? Because he is still trying to be incredibly diplomatic in response to a man who's been very undiplomatic towards him.
Yeah, that's a good picture of what's happened. And may I make three points? First of all, is everyone gets to this sort of place with President Trump. In the first term, when I was actually in Washington, Trump's best friend in the world was President Macron of France. And Macron did the first state visit, and then they fell out, and now they are, I mean, they sniped each other across across the social media channels. Theresa May had a very successful first visit in January 2017 to see President Trump, but they fell out eventually too. Because sooner or later, the president will say something which is so out there and so sort of unacceptable that you have to respond. And that's when he tends to lash out. Now, there's no question but that this outburst that we saw in the Oval Office yesterday is pretty strong, quite brutal, quite wounding. But it's far from unprecedented, although you may say the language is unprecedented. I mean, there have been lots of falling outs between American presidents and British prime ministers in the past. Harold Wilson and LBJ, because we wouldn't send troops to Vietnam. John Clinton and John Major and Bill Clinton over Gerry Adams' visa. Even Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan over the American invasion of Grenada. So there's lots of this in our history. And the third point, I mean, I don't know how it went across in the House of Commons, but Keir Starmer has a point when he says a special relationship is not just about relationship between the White House and the and number 10 between the president and the prime minister. The bedrocks of it are the defence, security and intelligence relationships, alongside the huge amount of cultural and people-to-people interchange and our shared history. And the relationship between the US and the UK will survive and be strong, really, whoever is in the White House and whoever is in number 10. So if I get past this, it may take a while.
But are those things really there anymore? Couldn't you flip that coin, Lord Darroch, and say, actually, it would be more helpful to say what we see, which is that we really don't have a special relationship with this current iteration of America. And that would allow us to, I don't know, fill our chests, broaden our shoulders, stand up a little bit higher?
Yeah, you can make that argument. It's a legitimate argument. But look, first of all, very few ambassadors to the European Union are huge fans of the term special relationship because it sounds so sort of needy and every country thinks it has a special relationship with America. So it's not one that we tend to use a lot. But there are aspects of the relationship which are unique. Notably, as I say, the defence cooperation, the intelligence cooperation and coordination, the meshing together of our security establishments. And I make two points about this. One, we could not do without, or our security rests very heavily on, first of all, American military power, and second, all the intelligence that we share with them. So this is crucial to the UK. And second, we still send 21% of our exports to America. So it's a hugely important commercial market for us. So, I mean, if you went for a complete rift with America, it would be very damaging for a number of aspects of our relationship and would hurt a lot of people in this country.
Sure, but there must be a tiny bit of you that when you heard President Trump say, you know, he's no Churchill, didn't you want Keir Starmer to stand up and say, well, mate, you're no Roosevelt either?
Yeah, that's a line you hear bandied around quite a lot nowadays. And of course, in one sense, you would have thought that would have been a great riposte. But as a diplomat, as a 40-year career diplomat, my advice to the Prime Minister would be to do exactly what he is doing, which is just basically to move on and to try and keep the temperature down and let things calm down, let the dust settle, keep cooperating, which we certainly are, at a military level in the region. And there'll be lots of, you know, intelligence going back and forwards and foreign policy experts will be talking. And at some point in the next few weeks, when a peg arises for it, get the president on the phone and talk about how, you know, what kind of exit strategy he has for this, which otherwise, this has expanded so quickly, this crisis in the Gulf. It's now involving so many different countries and so much is going on. You do wonder how the president is going to extract himself from it, because he's not, I think, going to get the regime change or the popular uprising he was calling for. So what's the exit strategy?
Do you think that President Trump is entirely well?
Yeah, you get asked that a bit, but I do think he is. I mean, he is a unique personality with a unique approach to being president. And I may not be a huge admirer of many of his policies, but, I mean, he's older now. But, you know, he is the same man who I observed at close quarters in his first term. And, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, he's a man who is capable of doing a two-hour speech, as we saw in Congress a couple of weeks ago. He can take, you know, press conferences for an hour and a half. A lot of what he says may be factually inaccurate, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Okay.
A lot of stuff in there. My 39-year-old man.
Yeah, he's got stamina. Maybe he's not got content. You are being an absolutely brilliant diplomat, five-star diplomat. So I wonder whether you can advise all of us, Lord Darroch, on this. How do we address this feeling that actually, as a country, we are unprepared for what's happening, we are vulnerable, and we haven't seen around a corner enough to protect ourselves?
Yeah, there is some truth in those assertions, and I'll come on to that. But the first thing to say is this is the most unpredictable, impulsive, and at times capricious American president, at least in recent history and maybe in all history. So you can't blame for him catching the world, you know, unawares quite often. And that's just the world that we live in, and you have to accept it. Second, in terms of this, are we unprepared? Are we not seeing what's coming around the corner? I think there are a lot of people who can see what a state the world is in and how many danger points there are around, but we are woefully underinvested in terms of our defence capability. And a little vignette of that is the way that this very expensive destroyer we're about to send off to provide air cover against drones and missiles for our Cyprus sovereign base, HMS Dragon, is still sitting in Portsmouth, and it'll take about a week to get there. And who knows, the action may be over by then. So we are woof, and this is a matter of generations, not a recent government's fault, but successive governments have not put enough money into defence. And in that sense, we just aren't as capable as we should be, given the dangers around in this world. The Strategic Defence Review pointed the way, but we actually now need some money spent. And I know there's not much money around, but this is a matter of potentially of national survival.
Do you honestly think that the action might be over within just a week?
I doubt it. But again, I come back to the nature of President Trump. And it's starting to dawn on Washington, it seems, because he said as much from the Oval Office yesterday, that maybe there won't be regime change and maybe the people who have been killed in the first wave of attacks will just be replaced. And you know, you wonder what the other objectives are apart from that, because the nuclear program was obliterated supposedly back in June. And I think they have bombed all the sites where missiles were being put together. So what's it carrying on for? I mean, what is the objective now? It's not at all clear. And when senior members of the US administration asked, they give different answers. So it's possible the president may look for an exit ramp quite soon.
The king is supposed to be travelling to the US in April, but we don't really know much more than that at the moment. Is that something that can still go ahead? Do you know if there would be conversations about actually maybe delaying that or saying nope?
Well, obviously, if the world is in even deeper crisis come April, then the Americans may say this isn't the moment for a state visit. But I think it's more than likely to go ahead. And certainly, I don't think we'll be pushing for it to be postponed, because the king is he's actually a very, very effective diplomat. And he gets on very well with the president. That's the evidence of their meetings. That's the evidence of the state visit a few months ago. And I think he can be very effective if there is still a rift in the relationship and healing it.
How much of a diplomatic headache is it for the palace, though? Because I take your point. I mean, for President Trump, this could be an absolutely marvellous thing. Everything suggests that he's incredibly fond of nearly all members of the royal family. But for King Charles himself, isn't it a bit tricky?
Yeah, but he's done lots of tricky visits in the past, and he's hosted President Trump for a day and they get on. And, you know, this is still a country that is hugely important to us for the defence and intelligence cooperation and trade reasons I mentioned. And he's a great national asset. So at all possible, we should use him. And I think, honestly, he would also see himself as doing something really potentially valuable and would want to do it if it's possible.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. That is Lord Darroch, former UK ambassador to the US. Gosh, you've got to have the skills to be a diplomat, haven't you? And Lord Darroch has the skills. Yes.
I don't think it would have suited either of us.
No, I don't think so, Jane.
Well, you'd have been better than me, but no.
With our propensity to just say it out loud.
I don't think it would have worked. So many of you pointing out, and it does keep being repeated, but it's being repeated because it was what Pete Hegseth claimed a little bit earlier. But Ron is among the many people who've said this. Would your newsreader please point out that the Americans are not the first to sink a ship with torpedoes since World War II? The UK, of course, sank the Argentinian battleship Belgrano. It was sunk by HMS Conqueror in 1982 during the Falklands War using torpedoes. So we do hear you, but I hate to break it to people. I don't think Pete Hegseth is a huge aficionado of British military history or indeed any kind of history, I suspect. But I mean, I could be wrong. He is one of the most extraordinary speakers, isn't he, Hegseth?
Yeah, would you like to get into a fact off with him?
Well, I'd give it a whirl, Fee.
I think you might win.
Yeah, I really would. I probably shouldn't recommend this, but it is fun if you have a moment after we finish. In fact, after Times Radio finishes, which it doesn't, so it leaves you with a bit of a conundrum. But do look up on YouTube and no doubt elsewhere, Kenny Everett's character, General Cheeseburger. Because when you look at General Cheeseburger, you'll think Hegseth almost instantly. Right, next on Times Radio, how do you solve the VAR problem? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
From Tokyo to the Tadawul, Wall Street to Warsaw, and Chicago to the City of London, the global financial markets never sleep. Make sure you're fully briefed on all the latest money movements and share price fluctuations with Times Radio Business Bulletins.
Every morning on Times Radio, early breakfast from 5 a.m. and every night at Drive from 5 p.m.
Times Radio Business Bulletins, keeping you well informed throughout the day, every day. Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
1983 election, she's won a landslide second term.
Police have been deployed to disperse crowds as the poll tax riots escalate.
Credit crunches continuing to spread from the USA.
Britain has left the European Union.
I mean, the list goes on. Boris, Liz,
we've
Richie.
Helped Britain invest through 45 years of change. That's why we're the UK's number one investment and savings platform, trusted by 2 million people. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest for it all. Investment returns vary. For claim verification, visit hl.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, sport with Vassos Alexander. We were right in the middle of a very special moment here in the Times Radio studio then. Just explain what you were talking about.
Well, because Vassos is a huge fan of the open water swimming and he swims in the Serpentine, which is right in the centre of London. It's in Hyde Park and it's a wonderful little open water swimming area. And if you go really early, I think if you're swimming outdoors as the dawn rises, there is something almost spiritual about it. It's just a little bit of magic, isn't it?
Yeah, there is. And sometimes you can swim
And you can look east as the sun is rising, and you can look west as the moon is coming down. And on a morning like this morning, when you had the full moon as well, it feels like you're just getting a little bit of magic into you before the day starts.
And apart from anything else, Jane, I think it's the fact that you are at ground level. Mm. So there are lots of other activities that you could be doing. You could go for a cycle ride or a run at dawn or whatever. But I think it's the fact that you're in the water. And so you're level with the ground. And in the Serpentine, that is a wonderful thing, isn't it? Because then you can see all, you know, the ducks and the swans going past and whatever it is. It is magic. I would highly recommend it to you. Okay. You look absolutely befuddled.
Oh, no, because I just go downstairs, put a brew on, toast a bagel, go back to bed and read the Times.
And that's spiritual in its own way.
It's spiritual. All of which puts VAR somewhat in perspective, but that's what Vassos is here to talk about. Now, this is such a crazy idea, this. The FA is thinking about the idea of something called a coach's challenge to decisions by the video assistant referee. Now, today's Times does have what I think we could describe, and indeed you have, as a full-throated denunciation of the notion by Martin Samuel. And he's always got opinions, says Martin, and I agree with some of them, though not all. But this, I think I'm with him. Right, explain, Vassos.
Sometimes it is difficult to know which side of the fence Martin lands in his pieces. So let me read you this and you can make your own minds up. Of all the ideas, he writes, advanced to solve the VAR crisis, this is by far the worst, least effective and most ill-considered, so of course the FA loves it. This is an idea by the FA chief exec, Mark Bullingham, to give the coaches a challenge, rather like in the NFL, you can challenge a decision on the field in American football or in cricket. You know, the batsman could say, actually, I don't think I did nick that. Could you just have a look, send it upstairs? Mm. Of course, as Martin says in his piece, the American football and cricket have natural pauses in the game and football doesn't. And furthermore, all goals. I mean, you would imagine that a coach would reserve this for a goal being scored.
Well, you'd think, but I wonder what would happen if it's, say, the 89th minute and you haven't used your challenge. You're just going to give it a whirl, aren't you?
Roger Federer did this the whole time during his tennis matches, you know, just to halt the momentum. Sometimes he would challenge a serve that was so far out, it was closer to the baseline than the service line. But it just halted the momentum. It just changed the energy around. Yeah. People would then laugh because it was such a bad challenge. Uh-huh. Yeah. And, you know, and everyone went, oh, Roger. And so, of course you would. And as Martin says, you know, what if, you know, there's something happened and you sort of, and then you see the other team going up the other end and they're about to score or might score. So can you challenge then to halt that attack? And does that seem fair? And anyway, all goals are checked by VAR anyway. That has to happen, as are red cards, as will second yellow cards be as of this summer, as at the World Cup will corners be. So as Martin writes, what are they going to challenge? Throw-ins?
Well, also, when are these games going to finish?
Exactly.
I mean, some of them are being played in the middle of the night. We're not going to get any sleep at all, are we?
Yeah, I mean, the Scotland game, the first Scotland game that kicks off at 2 a.m. our time. Burnley against Brentford on Saturday. Wonderful game. Burnley came down back from a 3-0 down to equalise, then scored a goal to win 4-3, one of the great comebacks of all time. No, VAR ruled that out for a tiny little half of a shoulder offside. Rightly, I mean, it's a matter of fact, right? And then Brentford scored, and then 90+8, Burnley score an equaliser, 4-4, which they lavishly celebrate. And then VAR goes, oh, actually, was there a handball? And VAR took 6 minutes... 8 minutes into injury time to decide that actually it was a handball. And so poor old Burnley, who aren't having the greatest season, ended up losing that game, which just for the sake of football, couldn't it have just... And the most recent controversy, and Martin mentions this in his piece, was Fulham's first goal against Tottenham on Saturday. There was a push in the back of the defender in the build-up to the goal, as there was almost exactly the same in the previous week, where Spurs had a goal disallowed against Arsenal. And so, obviously, the new Tottenham manager, Igor Tudor, was absolutely incandescent.
He's not had the best start,
has he? He's been here for 2 weeks, lost both games, and he has had exactly the same decision go against him in both matches. However, you know, to give VAR its due, they're trying to be light touch. So they're saying, you know, we're only going to do the clear and obvious errors. In neither of the cases against Arsenal when the Tottenham had a goal disallowed, or against Fulham when it was a goal against Tottenham? Was it a clear and obvious error from the goal? So the referee just saw it differently. The referee gave the foul against Arsenal, so VAR didn't overturn it. And the referee didn't give the foul against Fulham, so VAR didn't overturn it. So to be honest, the thing is, managers are always going to complain when a decision goes remotely wrong. But I think all of us would agree that we could do without six-minute delays. So VAR just get involved when it's a clear and obvious factual error, and we'll just sort of stomach it.
Are all of the leagues across the world in lockstep about VAR?
Well, I mean, there's no VAR in the Championship, for example. I was watching a Championship game, Middlesbrough against Birmingham City on Monday night. It was so lovely. A goal was scored, and I knew that was a goal. I checked the linesman's flag for offside. That wasn't up. A goal is a goal. I remember when it first came into the Premier League, and everyone, because the Bundesliga had it a season or two before us, and everyone in Germany was saying, just be careful, don't take it, we hate it, we hate it, we hate it. And you know, and we all now hate it, but it's here to stay. Mm. I mean, you know, in the the FA Cup, talking of the FA and Mark Bullingham's idea for the coaches' challenge. In the FA Cup, it only 747 teams enter the FA Cup. It only comes in when there are 16 left.
A couple of points here. John says, do you think VAR for corners in the World Cup is an attempt to put in more breaks in the game by the Americans for ads?
Oh, it's a good point.
It's possible, isn't it?
It may well be. Mm. And if it's just the World Cup, fine. But for goodness sake, you know, where will it end? What is it? What is he said? It's another blanket of football, saddling football with another blanket of VAR mission creep.
Nick says, what bugs me is the random nature of extra time. Why can't they do a rundown clock like in most other ball sports? It's odd, isn't it? Because extra time did for Liverpool last night, I should say, in that game against Wolves.
Yeah.
And it does seem, sometimes I think, well, it can't be 8 minutes or not, sometimes 10.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I know. This is something that came from the last World Cup where referees are trying to sort of give a more. I remember when like 3 minutes used to come up and it was like, absolutely, what? 3 minutes? Now 3 minutes is like the first half if you're lucky.
Mm. The sad thing is, it's undeniable. It has changed the nature of the celebration. So someone scores, and whereas they might in the past have gone hell for leather down the other length of the pitch, done a jig in front of their supporters, or if they want to irritate, in front of the opposing team's supporters, and now They have to stop. Sometimes they have to stop celebrating sort of a third of the way through its natural length because
it's going to be a check.
It's cobblers. It ruins the whole thing.
It does a bit because the currency of football, the goal, is so rare. And so you get such an explosion of positive energy from those fans when a goal is scored. And if they have to put a break on that, then so much of the joy is taken out of football. You're 100% right.
Well, Cole says football's already ridiculous. It's a non-sport. This will make it even more ridiculous.
Yeah, Cole's old school, isn't he?
I think so.
Very much so.
He likes jousting. they probably had VAR in that, didn't they? Back in the day. No? All right. It's Times Radio. Thank you very much, Vessels. Thank you for being here. In the next half an hour, Naz Shah will be with us to discuss her new book, Honoured, and her fascinating journey to Westminster. It was quite the journey, we have to say. You are with Times Radio at exactly 3:30. Here are the latest news headlines, and it's Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, good afternoon. The US Defence Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship in the Indian Ocean. Israeli strikes on Tehran are continuing for a fifth day, meanwhile. Pete Hegseth says the US strategy for the operation in Iran is clear.
Obliterate Iran's missiles and drones and facilities that produce them, annihilate its navy and critical security infrastructure, and sever their pathway to nuclear weapons. Iran will never possess a nuclear bomb, not on our watch, not ever.
Tehran has retaliated with strikes across the Gulf. Turkey claims a ballistic missile heading for its airspace has been shot down. Meanwhile, further flights are being arranged to help Britons leave the Middle East. A first charter plane is due to take off from Oman tonight. It could be 2 weeks before HMS Dragon is in place to protect Cyprus from ballistic missiles and drone attacks. Officials say the Type 45 destroyer will not set sail until next week. It's being brought out of maintenance and being fitted with the correct weapons. And the partner of a Labour MP has been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. David Taylor, a lobbyist married to Joni Reid, was one of three men arrested in London and Wales on suspicion of assisting a foreign intelligence service. Reid says she's never seen anything that made her suspect her husband had broken the law. And one more story. Police have raided the Police Federation's national headquarters in Leatherhead in Surrey. City of London police made three arrests on suspicion of fraud by abuse of position. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. Peter and Patrick are identical twins until suddenly, at the age of 35, they weren't. Patrick was diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy, a rare inherited heart condition. So he was referred to Professor William McKenna's specialist team at University College Hospital and went on to have the heart transplant that eventually saved his life. But then Peter, his identical twin, developed exactly the same symptoms caused by the same condition. He too needed an urgent heart transplant, and he too was able to have one. 20 years later, they took part in BHF's London to Brighton Cycle Challenge on a tandem, celebrating the 20th anniversary of their transplant and getting their lives back so that they could once again be identical twins. Peter and Patrick survived, but many don't. British Heart Foundation is funding research to cure inherited heart disease so that they can help more people survive. When you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
And that reminds me, it is only Wix Proud as a Peacock Thursday tomorrow, isn't it? It's our last ever one.
Well, Jane, I was going to say, I mean, I hope that everybody can just stop and give it the respect it deserves. 100%. Because we've been running the competition since before Christmas.
Well, I think since before the Boer War. It's been a while.
Is it back in the days of Cole's jousting?
Yes.
It might have been.
Well, Cole's been back in touch. He says, I'm 70, but with a 19-year-old head. Sounds like a regular listener, to be honest. You're very welcome, Cole. Yeah,
I think that's the way we like them. Yeah. And yes, why not take the opportunity to win a £250 Wix voucher tomorrow, because there will never be another opportunity again.
And honestly, you can get a lot done with £250 in Wix. Sean draws our attention to the fact that after Pete Hegseth gave his press conference today, it all went over to Dan Kane, who's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Sean says he started his presentation by stating that he hoped he wouldn't kill anybody with his laser pointer. I felt it was a bit jarring, but don't worry. We're all in safe hands, it seems.
Sean, that's a very nice spot. Ryan has just informed us that it was the 4th of December. It was a great day. I don't know how we could have forgotten it. That's when we started Proud as a Peacock, and we're going to bow out almost at the 4th of March. Wonderful times.
Absolutely. Do join in with that tomorrow. You can, in fact, get a wiggle on and enter now. It's Jane and Fee at times.radio. Tell us what you're proud of this week. Now to our guest. Naz Shah has been the Labour MP for Bradford West since back in 2015. And if you think Westminster is simply too full of identical ex-lawyers with PPE degrees from Oxford or Cambridge, well, she is a contrast. At the age of 12, she was packed off to Pakistan on a supposed holiday that turned into a three-year ordeal and included forced marriage to her cousin when she was 15. When she was 18 and back in this country, her mother was sentenced to 20 years in prison for the murder of a man the family knew as Uncle Azam. In fact, he was a rapist who'd abused Naz's mother and forced Naz's mother to have sex with other men. Now, Naz Shah's memoir, Honoured, attempts to make sense of her childhood and explains how, against the odds, she didn't just survive, she triumphed. Just to warn you, the interview does contain descriptions of suicidal thoughts and domestic abuse that some listeners may find upsetting. We began by talking about how very few politicians can claim that they spent their early teenage years in a remote village clearing up buffalo dung. But that was true for Naz.
It is. You had the buffaloes, you had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, clean the buffalo crap and the clean crap, which didn't have hay and things mixed in it, you'd put in a basket, take up to the rooftop, you'd turn it into like patties, so you'd dry them out with the sun and the heat during the day, and the next day they'd be used for fuel to, you know, in the stove, if you like. So yeah, that was a normal daily routine.
We'll get on to how you ended up doing this as a teenage girl. That was in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Your book, Honoured, has a very sweet picture of you in very smart-looking British school uniform. And you look studious, you look very sweet.
Thank you.
But that, well, there was an awful lot going on in your life at that point.
Yeah.
And that was that your last British formal school portrait?
Yes, I was 12 years old. That was the last year that I was in school in the UK.
And what happened after that?
I was sent to Pakistan, and then I didn't come back from Pakistan until I was 15 after a forced marriage. So I was 15 in November, and I was forced into marriage in December. And then I came back to the UK, but I never went back to a British school again, simply because I went and started working, and I worked packing nappies. And then I went up in the world, and I went and started doing laundry, the NHS laundry at Society Linen Hire. And then I went up in the world and I started packing crisps, Seabrook's crisps. So, and then my world came crashing down because my mum got arrested for murder.
I mean, there's so much just in that answer. You've also been homeless. At one point, you were, after your mum went to prison, you were sleeping in a crack den. When people say, oh, there's not enough real people in politics, I think you could quite legitimately turn around and say, well, there's me.
I'm very real. I mean, the truth is that anybody in life circumstances is only ever 2 to 3 steps away from being homeless. And I've been there. I've done that. I've slept in, literally, because I didn't have anywhere to sleep, slept in a crack house. I've literally slept on, you know, the second time I tried to kill myself was I was on a mattress that was in a spare room where the dog slept. And I was sleeping on that, and it was Eid. And you've got, like, there's, you know, being homeless, being not having anywhere to put your head down, not having sofa surfing, literally. And sometimes you end up on sofas that you just wouldn't have thought imaginable. And being in, and I can still smell the heroin, you know, of a drug user using heroin, using crack cocaine. And that smell is really, really distinctive when they've just got the foil there.
What is it like?
It's a stickly, sweet smell. It's a very, very unique smell. I've never smelled it, you know, since. And it's just, you're literally on your tod, if you like, and you've got nowhere to go, and you think you're at the space where you just don't want to wake up, you know?
Yeah, you've had some phenomenally tough experiences.
I have indeed.
We just go back to the way the book starts with one of your earliest memories is you're 5 and you're running for help. Tell us about that.
Anvil Street, running down up the stairs. It was a back-to-back house, and you went into the bottom in the basement where the living room and the kitchen was. And I ran up because my dad was beating my mum. And I went up to the neighbours, another flight of stairs, and crashed, you know, banged on their door to tell them to come and stop because my mum was saying, go get somebody, go get somebody. You know, and she was just, her eyes, it's, you know, there are moments in my life when I still see my mother's eyes looking up to me, looking out to me. That was my first time that I saw my mum literally saying to me, help me, you know, and I was only 5 years old.
Yeah, I mean, most of us, we're fortunate if we see that perhaps once or twice in our mother's eyes, perhaps when she's elderly and not feeling very well.
Yeah.
But to experience that when you were 5, little wonder that I think writing this book did really impact you, didn't it?
Hugely. You know, I got diagnosed with PTSD in 2024. I mean, there's some of that book that was written in 2017. I was the first time it was pitched to me as an idea that I should write it was in when I won my election, which was in 2015. Then I realised by the time I got to 2024, when I started writing again, then I got diagnosed with PTSD. Then I had EMDR therapy to help me through. And then I've, you know, and I'm still going through that journey of, you know, healing from all that, all the trauma and the experience of trauma. And then you kind of like, you learn as you carry on and you have these, you know, when my daughter Leanna and my niece Inaya, I remember when they were 15 and they were sat there just giggling on the couch and with their phones in their hand and they were just giggling. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like, oh my God, at your age, I was married. And you're just carefree. The idea that they're just carefree. And in some ways, it's really humbling because you think, We've broken the cycle.
You've done that.
Yeah, we've broken that cycle. No more will my niece, my daughter ever have them kind of, you know, patriarchal, that kind of attitude. They are raised to be the strong, independent people that they are. And young women now, you know, in their 20s. But it was just those little things, they always come and catch you up. No matter how much you think you've put them away, at some point, that little filing cabinet that you think you've locked away, the things seep out at you. So writing the book was really, really difficult. It wasn't the easiest job.
No. Well, you've done a great job.
Thank you.
And it's actually incredibly educational, and I certainly learned a great deal from it. What I think people will need to try to understand is why, when your dad eventually left your mum and he ran off with a, which was a teenage neighbour, wasn't she?
Yeah, 16-year-old.
A 16-year-old. It was you and your mum and your siblings who paid the price for that. Now, that just seems extraordinary. So just explain how that all happens.
So in a patriarchal society, it's the women that bear the burden of shame. And that's the reason the book is called Honoured is about women are honoured. You know, we talk about honour killings, and there's no honour in killing. There's no, and it's always a woman who carries that burden. So the man can do what he wants. It's that age-old thing of, you know, a man can do what he wants, and it's notches on the bedpost, and a woman does it, and she's promiscuous, and she's whatever names they call her. It's the same concept. It's the idea that a woman doesn't have the honour. And to me, that's wrong. And it's what Giselle has been saying recently about we need to flip the concept of shame. That's exactly what honour is. Honour is the other side of that. And it's exactly the same thing. I'm just saying it in a different language. And that honour cannot just belong to men. It belongs to women. Women should not be the carriers of shame. They should be the carriers of honour, because that's what women are. Because women, you know, the amount of trauma that women carry, you know, when my mum went to prison, it wasn't her who just went to prison. We served that sentence with her. And yet women, the majority of women who are in prison, have been abused or had some kind of, you know, they've had a life experience which puts them there. There are so many facets to this book that we need to understand in terms of experience, of women's experiences, of children's experiences, of experience of abuse. The concept of it is that shuts women up, that we don't talk about it. We don't talk about abuse. We don't talk about any of these things. Even today in Britain, women from mainstream society, not even having a cultural difference, you know, will not talk about these things, because we just don't. And when we're angry, we beat ourselves of why are we angry. We don't understand our mental health responses. We don't know how to unpick them. The support services aren't there. So I think I'm really, really hopeful that this starts a number of conversations. Ultimately, the bottom line for me is I want somebody to read this and think, okay, if she can do it, I can do it.
Well, I think a lot of people will be inspired. I really do mean that. We need to go back to how your mum somehow got a life together for you and your siblings. Unfortunately, it did involve a man who, and this is the really, and you're very honest about it, you rather liked this man.
Yeah.
He was superficially good to you, good to the family.
He bought down, you know, he owned a local warehouse. He bought fruit. He bought, you know, sweets for us. To us, he was Uncle Azam. I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. And when he died, I grieved. I genuinely grieved for him.
What was going on?
He had sexually exploited my mum for years. My mother was a vulnerable woman in her early 20s with three children. Well, she was pregnant when my dad left her, living in abject poverty, you know, wanting to buy a house, sold her jewellery. He bought the house in his name because she didn't qualify for a mortgage. The day he took her to the house, that was the first time he raped her. He sexually exploited her. We understand the concept of sexual exploitation now. She was a vulnerable single parent who didn't know the language in a strange country. He exploited that, abused her, you know, literally when he went to prison, he was a drug trafficker. You know, he exploited her from prison for favours on the inside. And she, when I was 12, my mum sent me to Pakistan because he, in his words, the grass was greener with your daughter now.
In his line of sight.
Yes. Yeah. So she sent me to Pakistan when I was 12. I didn't come back until I was 15 after a forced marriage. And then my sister was growing up, she was 11. And then it was like, okay, now she's growing up. And at that point, my mum killed him. And she went to prison, and she was given a tariff of 20 years, and she never told the story. She never told anybody that she'd been abused.
You didn't understand at the time, but your mother had murdered Azam, and she'd put arsenic in some food because of the horrendous abuse that she'd suffered for many, many years. It was only when a couple of pressure groups got together, the South All Black Sisters and Justice for Women, and your mum somehow made contact with them. How did all that happen?
So if you remember in 1990, there was a case of Girindji Dilawalia, who then changed the law. South All Black Sisters, she was a woman who killed, was driven to kill her husband who'd beaten her. And it was self-defence, and they took it to appeal, and they won that appeal, and Girindjit was rightfully freed. And what happened with my mum was she reached out to South All Black Sisters. Now, when Pragna went to see her, she then, to Pragna, it was very clear, you know, she's worked with women who have been abused. Why does a woman kill? Why does an Asian woman who, you know, has got three children, the house and whatever, killed? Nobody gets up in the morning thinking, I'm going to kill somebody today. So there must have been a reason behind it. So she counselled her, pieced it together, and it was a couple of years. It took more than a year to get the whole story out of my mum. And then my mum refused to talk about it. She was like, well, these are grounds for appeal. And she was like, nope, because it affects my izzet.
Right, that's the honour that... Izzet is how it's pronounced.
Izzet,
And you, meanwhile, outside with your siblings... married at that point, but it was, I mean, the fact that you just somehow kept putting one foot in front of another is remarkable to those of us who we now, I realise, you know, I've led such a sheltered life. How did you do that?
You don't have a choice. It's flight or fight, isn't it? You've got your mother in prison, you've attempted suicide, your mother's like, well, what's going to happen to me if you go and kill yourself? Then you feel a really, really huge burden of responsibility. You've got two siblings, you have to. You really don't have a choice, because I've tried to kill myself, that didn't work, I'm back here where I am, so I'm just going to have to get on with it. So it's like, suck it up, pull your boots up and get on with it. And then you've got a campaign to fight. You know, you've got to get your mother out of prison. You've got to give stability to these siblings. You can't have them going through what you've been through. So you're trying to shelter them. You're trying to be mother, sister, you know, all of the things to your brother and sister. And you haven't got a clue how to do it as an 18-year-old because they're 13 and 11.
Yeah.
I didn't. I just didn't know. And I didn't know how to manage a budget. I didn't know how to run a household, you know. So I didn't have a clue. But you had to get on with it. You didn't have a choice. Because who was going to fight the fight then?
I think people would be wondering, well, here she is, though, now an MP, strides around the Palace of Westminster.
Yeah.
People are going to have to read this book, I should say, to find out exactly how you made that incredible shift in your life. It really is it's a cracking story. But what I really appreciate about this book is that you raise a number of issues that probably, well, I certainly couldn't in book form or anywhere else. It would be thought of as racist. It would be thought of as wrong. But you go right in there. You talk about family voting. You talk about cousin marriage. I think I'm right in saying that your grandfathers were brothers, weren't they?
Yep, my grandfathers were brothers. My first husband was also my first cousin.
Right. I mean, what do you think about that?
So cousin marriages, I mean, the latest statistics, I work closely with Bradford Royal Infirmary, it's literally something that is dying out. You know, it's not different to what... It's just... how I look at my community, including the wider community, the non-Muslim community, elect me. They're the people that have honoured me. And they're people, like any society, that move on. And that society changes. So you take the community with you on a journey. What you don't do is try and throw the community under the bus. For me, the thing is, I look at when I, you know, I was on an aeroplane and I watched Downton Abbey, mm-hmm. where the woman has got divorced and she's not allowed to be in the same room as the king anymore, right? Because she's brought shame.
Well,
it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But it was in a different era. But that society isn't where it was then. British society isn't there now. And it's same with the Asian society. We're not where we were 25 years ago. When I was campaigning for my mum back in the 90s, people would say, we support you, but we can't add our name to your petition. Now, in 2016, since being a member of parliament, Samia Shahid was murdered in Pakistan. She was raped and murdered. And every businessman, the top 25 businesses in Bradford, Pakistani origin, put their name to those tables and said, we honour her. That is the change in society, you know, so it has shifted, massively shifted.
Right. I think some people would perhaps take issue a bit with that and say it's got to shift more. I mean, we cannot have first cousins marrying each other in the United Kingdom in 2026, just not on.
The way to manage it would be about cultural shift, wouldn't it? Cultural change. It's not about legal things, it's about cultural shifts, because what we don't want to do, there are people who still have relatives' marriages. And there are people who are, you know, we would encourage people not to. It's not the dun. It's not something that was, you know, prevalent back in the 80s. It is not that thing. It's not the same anymore. Consanguinity isn't that. It isn't. There is, you know, the risk of cousin marriage and disability. If you look at the stats, there's also the higher stat is also that risk. It goes up to, I think it's 3 in 100 at a usual marriage, and it goes up to 6 in 100 if you have a cousin marriage. That is the same applies to once you have somebody who's over the age of 30. You know, so even your indigenous population, once you're over 30, that statistic still goes up to 6 in 100. So what we do is we try and encourage people and get testing, etc. And that's the way we move society. Okay. We move culture rather than, you know, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You literally take society on a journey with you. And my community is no different to any other community.
Can we talk about, you do say at one point that there are Bradford councillors who are in really prominent positions.
Yes.
And they don't really speak English properly or well.
Oh, God, yes. I've been campaigning about this for years now.
They're still there, aren't they?
Yeah. So now it's less so. Again, even in the last 10 years, 11 years since I've been in politics. But Bradryism is like, it's a real thing. It is clan politics.
Bradry.
Bradry means clan politics. So it's no different to your Etonians. It's no different to unions. It's no different to, you know, blocks of women. You know, the Parliamentary Women's Party, the Labour Women's Network. You'd say that is a clan of women coming together. Where it's different is simply because this one is, there is no political aim. It's about men having power for the sake of having power. It's misogynistic in nature. It's about men having power. That is still an issue in Britain, in places like Bradford West. I will continue to call it out. And the young people have shifted. Young people do not do the block voting like they did 10 years ago, even in Bradford. So young people will break out of those shackles. It's not about it's not about position and power. It's about actual policies now. So again, you have to take the community with you to offer them an alternative. And I think in Bradford West that is changing. Has it changed enough? No, it hasn't. Absolutely not.
How do they regard you, those men? I mean, some of them, frankly, must hate your guts.
Well, some of them will, and you know what? I'm not in the job to be liked. I'm in the job to do what I need to do, right? So I'm not, you're never going to be, if you're liked by everybody, you're not doing your job. When I first got elected, I remember lots of them did support me. Went through my selection process, but once I'd been selected as a candidate, I had that support. Then what happened was there was an expectation that they would get whoever they wanted in as councillors and not have a fair process. And I said, no, I didn't make that deal with anybody. So it was like, they fell out with me. And then they tried to deselect me. Every single selection process that they've had, they've attempted to deselect me.
But all of this, I mean, in fact, everything we've talked about in the last couple of minutes, that is, it's sort of why reform gets votes, isn't it?
I think reform gets votes. I think, look, there are bad practices in every single community. There is not a community that doesn't have misogyny. There is not a community. If we look at misogyny, for example, right now, we had people who were raised in Buckingham Palace. Right, who have lost their, but you know, the idea of misogyny just affecting my community is one for the birds. When we have to change things, where the idea that abuse happens just in my community is another one for the birds. What we have to do, what we have to accept is, from my perspective, reform are the magpie who shine a light on something that's small and bright and make it shine in the sunshine and bang the drum. And people on the sensible side don't want to bang the drum because they don't need to bang the drum to get the attention. Their work needs to speak for itself. What we're not doing well enough, as far as I'm concerned, is being able to reach those communities and say, actually, this is what is happening.
And is one of Labour's problems, the man in charge, Sir Keir Starmer, who, for all his decency, I don't think anyone doubts that he's anything other than a doughty and thoroughly decent human being, he cannot get a message across.
Well, I'm hoping that's going to change. I really, really do. I think, look, from my perspective, as not coming from a political background and coming in very, very from a working class, you know, background, what I saw with Boris and what I saw in 9 years of opposition and so many churns of prime ministers, Brexit became the vortex that took out the parliamentary debate. After Brexit, we just got past the 2019 election, and then we had COVID. After COVID, we had Partygate. So it's an extreme, going from Boris Johnson, who used to ruffle his hair behind the speaker's chair and come in, and the big I am, to that prim, proper, suited former, you know, director DPP, of public prosecution, and leading a country. And he has. He is decent. That I absolutely agree with, and nobody's disagreeing with that. Is he the best communicator in comparison to, you know, the boisterous Boris Johnson? No, he isn't. Right. So, but does he have a skill set in other things? Yes, he does. And having, I think we've got a long way to go to be able to communicate our message because we've got that noise. We've got that noise of Farage on the opposite benches. Yeah.
So who would be better? Who might take on Farage better?
Well, I think, look, at the moment he's a prime minister, there's no vacancy. I don't know what's going to happen in May. I genuinely don't. There's always this talk of, you know, there's going to be somebody else, there's going to be somebody else. It might be that he's still there in 2029 taking us into the election. We don't know. Things can change. One thing I've learned in politics is never bet, you know, because you never know what's going to happen around the corner. We didn't know Iran was going to get attacked over the weekend. We didn't know we were going to move on from the idea of Gorton and Denton within a 48-hour news cycle.
So quick.
I don't know what's going to happen in May. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few years. I genuinely don't. So I'm not a betting person, but I was one of those people who signed the letter to say we should have let Andy Burnham stand. I really, really did feel that from a political point of view, he would have been good to bring back into the Parliamentary Labour Party and to start getting our message across. That's what I did feel.
Nash Shah, who is the Labour MP for Bradford West, and her book is called Honoured. It's out now. If you have been affected by any of the issues discussed in that interview, you can email feedback@times.radio and we'll point you in the direction of resources that you may need. Now, it's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Philly cheesesteak is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add 2 beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions and even more cheese. The Philly cheesesteak. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
I thought that I'd seen beauty. Then I sailed where icebergs gleam. I thought I'd witnessed nature, but this surpassed my dream. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And thank you for your messages this afternoon. This from Sarah about Nash Shah. What a woman. I don't tend to vote Labour, but I would vote for her if I could. And what else from Rose? Terrific guest, Jane. Thank goodness for women like her. Rosemary, actually, I do apologise. Thank you for that. Robert, though, says it isn't true that cousin marriage has completely died out. There are new arrivals from Muslim countries who are bringing their unreformed cultural traditions with them. Anna says, pass on my regards to Naz. What a courageous woman. And her mother as well. I'm going to buy that book. The best to her, her mother and her family. And this is an honest one from Alistair, who says, wow, I've met Naz Shah a couple of times. And if I'm honest, I found her rather annoying. But my humble apologies, Naz. I understand you a little better now. Thank you. We really do appreciate your messages and the interest you take in us here at Times Radio. Keep them coming. John Pienaar is with you now. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. We're back tomorrow from 2. Our producer today, Felix Forbes, and our technical operator, the ever reliable Ryan Boyden. John is next. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. I'm John Pienaar at 4 o'clock with Times Radio Drive.
Here are the headlines. The US Defense Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship in the Indian Ocean. And it could be 2 weeks before the UK's HMS Dragon is in place to protect Cyprus from ballistic missiles and drone attacks. And coming up, is Donald Trump souring on the so-called special relationship, or could this be a temporary blip? Our World Affairs editor, Catherine Philp, and a former National Security Advisor are joining me to talk about it. And I'll be talking to one of the UK's former senior generals about what the conflict in the Middle East is revealing about our defensive vulnerabilities.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The US Defense Secretary says an American submarine has sunk an Iranian warship off Sri Lanka. Pete Hegseth says it's the first American sinking of an enemy ship by a torpedo since World War II. Sri Lanka's Deputy Foreign Minister says at least 80 people were killed in the Indian Ocean attack. Hegseth says the Iranian regime will be destroyed.
We are only 4 days into this, and the results have been incredible. Historic, really. Only the United States of America could lead this. Only us. But when you add the Israeli Defense Forces, a devastatingly capable force, the combination is sheer destruction for our radical Islamist Iranian adversaries. They are toast, and they know it.
It could be 2 weeks before HMS Dragon is in place to protect RAF Akrotiri and Cyprus from ballistic missiles and drone attacks. Officials say the Type 45 destroyer will not set sail until next week. It's being brought out of maintenance, being fitted with the correct weapons. James Cartledge, the Shadow Defence Secretary, says it's being deployed way too late.
I don't understand why she wasn't sent many days ago. Dragon is a Type 45. That is an air defence destroyer. Incredibly important. It can intercept missiles that will be incoming to Cyprus. Hopefully that won't happen, but as part of her defence, she's a critical element. She should have been there days ago.
The Prime Minister's updated MPs on British deployments to the Middle East. Sir Keir Starmer's told the Commons British resources were pre-deployed to the region over a number of weeks.
Radar systems were pre-deployed. Ground-based air defence was pre-deployed. Counter-drone systems were pre-deployed. And F-35 jets were pre-deployed. Mr. Speaker, that is why, since Saturday morning, multiple F-35s and Typhoons have been in operation not just in the Middle East, but across Cyprus. Further missions were flown overnight, Typhoons defending in particular Qatar, and F-35s defending other regional partners.
The Iranian ambassador has been summoned to the Foreign Office. Minister Chris Elmore has been updating MPs on that. The partner of a Labour MP has been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. David Taylor, a lobbyist married to Joni Reid, was one of three men arrested in London and Wales on suspicion of assisting a foreign intelligence service. Reid says she's never seen anything that made her suspect her husband had broken the law. Police have raided the Police Federation's national headquarters in Leatherhead in Surrey. City of London police made three arrests on suspicion of fraud by abuse of position. The government has launched a review to tackle anti-Semitism in schools and colleges. Anti-Semitic incidents related to education are double pre-2023 levels. And Luke Donald will captain Europe's Ryder Cup team at Adair Manor in Limerick in 2027. He's aiming to make history by winning three tournaments in a row. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. I'll have more for you in a moment on the breaking news that three men, including the partner of a serving MP, have been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. The Times policy editor, Ollie Wright, is going to be joining me to get us up to speed on that story. And also on Drive today, Keir Starmer was cheered by Labour MPs in the Commons earlier. Now, no great surprise there. It's what they do every Wednesday at question time. But here's the interesting thing. They actually seem to mean it, including some of those Labour MPs who keep saying privately they can't wait to see the back of Starmer as their leader and our Prime Minister. So a little later, I'm going to be looking at weather, getting on President Trump's bad side over the war in Iran, whether being mockingly compared to Winston Churchill for refusing to quickly and fully back US attacks on Iran, having blown a hole in the so-called special relationship. Has Starmer actually strengthened his position with British voters who don't much rate or like him? Is it possible, just possible, that standing by principles of international law, as he says, and calling out the lack of a clear US plan for the war and its aftermath, that it may have stayed off, at least to an extent, the threat to Starmer's premiership? And here is another broader and bigger question. With President Trump pouring scorn on Britain's Prime Minister in front of the world, and with the UK's military weakness so exposed in the Middle East, have we been forced to ask ourselves, can we really continue to call ourselves a major strategic power? Tell me what you think. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, retweet to @TimesRadio. But first, the Scottish Labour MP Joni Reid has released a statement saying she has no part in her husband's business activities after it was revealed that he's been arrested on suspicion of spying for China. This is after an announcement in the Commons earlier from the Security Minister Dan Jarvis saying that three men had been arrested. And we can talk now to Ollie Wright, the policy editor at The Times. Welcome to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Ollie, can you just tell us more? What can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, I mean, details at the moment, I should say, are quite limited. Clearly, one of the reasons why the statement was given by Dan Jarvis today was because of this man, David Taylor, who is the partner of Joni Reid, who's a Labour MP. So it has echoes of, you know, previous Chinese spying scandals in Parliament. Listeners will remember Christopher Berry. He was a researcher working for the China Research Group within Parliament. He was arrested and was investigated for spying along with another man, Christopher Berry. Now, that case collapsed, but, you know, at that time, figures from the national security world were very clear that, you know, there was an active attempt to infiltrate Britain's institutions, and this appears to be another one.
Yes, and the security minister, Dan Jarvis, what was his message to MPs, apart from, I guess, simply reporting to them on where we are?
Yeah, I mean, he was very guarded. I mean, most of the questions that he received, he dead-batted away. He said, you know, really, I can't talk about it. It's an ongoing investigation. But, you know, he did make the point that, you know, the authorities were taking us very seriously, that, you know, it was part of a wider investigation into Chinese influence in the UK. And, you know, this was something that the government was concerned about.
Okay, Ollie, thank you so much. Ollie Wright there, policy editor at The Times. So let's talk about Keir Starmer, who was doing his job at Question Time in the House of Commons earlier this afternoon. Now, the criticism from the president, it wasn't just from the president today, it came from the opposition, as after the president had his say.
By the way, I'm not happy with the UK either. That island that you read about, the lease, okay, he made it for whatever reason, he made a lease of the island. Somebody came and took it away from him. And it's taken 3-4 days for us to work out where we can land there. It would have been much more convenient landing there as opposed to flying many extra hours. So we are very surprised. This is not Winston Churchill that we're dealing with.
So a scornful Donald Trump last night. And today, the U.S. Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, had an update on U.S. military operations.
Our warfighters have maximum authorities granted.